that, hey, you can encrypt and authenticate data using public keys, which is really cool. But in fact, Diffie and Hellman imagined that you could do something even better. They didn't have a construction, but they imagined that you could do public key signatures. Now, signatures are different from authenticators. Authenticators are something that you can verify them only if you're one of the people who could have computed them. But signatures are something that one person computes and then broadcasts to everybody, for everybody to verify. So that's a neat idea. They didn't have any examples. And then Rivest, Shamir, and Edelman, the RSA papers, one of them being Martin Gardner article, another one being the official RSA paper the next year, came along and proposed the following horrifically bad signature system. What they proposed was that, okay, you have a public key P times Q. You have some secret primes, P and Q, and you publish P times Q. You also publish a big random exponent E. They proposed figuring out the inverse of E modulo P minus 1, Q minus 1 first, and then reciprocating that to find E. And now, having specified the PQ and the E, your signature of a message M, M being between 0 and PQ minus 1, is some Eth root of M mod PQ. S is a signature of M if the Eth power of S mod PQ is equal to M. Now, this system, compared to what we now might call RSA, is really bad. First of all, it's extremely slow. For verification, you have to compute an Eth power mod PQ, which, depending on your parameter sizes, could be hundreds, thousands of multiplications mod PQ. More importantly, even if you're willing to tolerate that slowness, the system is horrifically insecure. It does not stop attackers from forging messages with signatures. For instance, if you take S equals 1 and M equals 1, it satisfies that equation. S to the E minus M is a multiple of PQ. Now, both of these problems and some others were fixed by the Raven-Williams system, which managed to achieve, well, substantially better, much, much better verification speed and good signing speed and, most importantly, some security. This was a breakthrough of Gaussian proportions. Thank you, thank you, thank you. In all seriousness, even for those of you who haven't seen Sneakers recently, the Raven-Williams system really was the first good signature system. And it's not just good, it's very good. It's still holding up. It's one of the best systems out there. Here are the four important changes from RSA to Raven-Williams, which I've summarized in three paragraphs here, citing two papers on one slide. I decided that this being still November, I would avoid singing Five Golden Rings. But anyway, Rabin said, first of all, for security, hash your message. There's some standard public hash function H, which, let's say your PQs are 2048, 2049 bits, and your H might be SHA-2048, which for any given message produces a 2048-bit output. You feed your message through that hash H and then compute the root S, and that's your signature of the message M. And then Rabin also said instead of having your exponent E be some part of your public key, every user generates a big random E, let's just have everybody use exponent 2, which of course makes the verification dramatically faster. Using a small exponent, and well, 2 is as small as you can reasonably get, just squaring S mod PQ is much, much faster than computing an Eth power, hundreds or thousands of multiplications. Here's just one squaring mod PQ, and check if you have the same result as this hash of your message. Now, there's maybe I should say, if you look at what people now call RSA, then they'll typically have small exponents E. But RSA requires that the exponent E be relatively prime, the P minus 1 and Q minus 1, the smallest E you can imagine. People sometimes talk about 17 or 3 as the minimum possible, and that's still not as fast. Cubing mod PQ is, of course, quite a bit slower than squaring mod PQ. So Rabin had the fastest verification that's out there. There's a disadvantage of using exponent 2, because 2 divides P minus 1, Q minus 1, which is that only about a quarter of the hash values, and assuming H is reasonably well distributed, only about a quarter of the M's have signatures. Only about a quarter of your numbers between 0 and PQ minus 1 has square roots mod PQ, which Rabin fixed by saying, well, okay, if you can only sign a quarter of your messages, prepend a random number, R, to your message before signing it. And then if your first R doesn't work, try again and keep trying until you've found an R that works. On average, you try about 4 R's, almost exactly 4 R's on average, assuming, again, some reasonable distribution of the H values. Of course, there's a very large variance, and, well, even if you're not worried about the variance, the variability in signing time, it's annoying to have to try several different R's and keep searching until you find a square mod PQ. And Williams came up with a much better solution, which is, let's just tweak the squares a little bit, tweak the square roots a little bit. If you have some hash value and you see that it's not a square mod PQ, then also try the negative of the hash value mod PQ, try that divided by 2 or the original 1 divided by 2, so allowing extra factors of plus or minus 1 and 2 in the signatures. All of those you can try simultaneously very efficiently, and one of those is guaranteed to be a square mod PQ, assuming that P and Q are chosen in some reasonable way as listed at the bottom of the slide here. There's exactly 4 ways to write any number mod PQ as E times F squared, where E and F, the tweaks there are E is plus or minus 1, F is 1 or 2. So for any particular hash value, you can come up with the first R you try, or you can leave that R entirely if you wanted. The first R you tried, you will find an E, F, and F that work. All right, so that's the Raven-Williams system, is making these improvements to RSA. Again, nowadays when people talk about RSA, they'll usually include some of Raven's improvements in it. And then squaring makes it even better than what people call RSA, and then Williams' improvement to squaring gives us basically the best system we have now. There's lots of other tweaks, which I've briefly summarized here. If you don't like computing Jacobi symbols, I saw one standard that said, well, Raven-Williams is of course faster than RSA for verification, but it has a code size disadvantage for computing Jacobi symbols. Ooh, scary, hard to implement. But that's easy to get rid of. You don't have to compute Jacobi symbols. You end up implicitly computing them as part of your square roots. You can make F longer. You can speed up verification at the expense of attaching some extra information to F. If that sounds bad because you're worried about bandwidth, then you can go the other way, and without too much cost in your verification, you can compress F to half size, an idea of Bleichenbacher. It's well known you can compress the public key PQ. There's a trick to make it half size, and then Coppersmith noticed a few years ago you could actually get it down to 1/3 size. You can compress the signed message by choosing your hash function sensibly, doing message recovery. And, well, there's all these improvements to Raven-Williams, which are orthogonal to the security features I'm going to talk about, but they do motivate using Raven-Williams for even more applications than you might think. The core reason to use Raven-Williams remains the original feature advertised by Raven and Williams, that the signature verification is extremely fast. And if you have some application, like at the bottom here I've mentioned domain name system security, signing DNS records, they have to be verified tens of thousands of times by computers that are busy doing other things, tens of thousands of times every second. And for that application, you really need very fast verification. Raven-Williams is the obvious choice of signature system. With that motivation in mind, let me recap the security question here. What is faced by someone trying to attack the Raven-Williams signature system? Well, the attacker gets to see your public key, of course, the P times Q, and the attacker gets to see a bunch of legitimate signed messages generated in some way. I'll get back to that in a moment. The attacker then, after looking at a bunch of signed messages, tries to successfully forge a new message. The forgery, the output of this attack, is successful if, well, M prime here, one of the outputs, is a different message from one of the legitimately signed messages, and the rest of the output satisfies the signature verification equation, which at this point, in case you didn't get it from the description before, the verification equation is EFS squared is the hash of R, comma M, modulo PQ, PQ being the public key. All right, the big question is, what's the best attack? What's the maximum chance of success of an attack against this system? Now, the answer can depend on your message generator. Different users, different applications have different ways of generating messages, and sometimes they seem more secure than others. Sometimes the message generator is uninfluenced by the attacker. Sometimes there's no communications channel from the attacker to the message generator. Sometimes there is a communications channel. Sometimes the attacker can dramatically influence the messages being signed. Extreme case, maybe there's a buffer overflow in the message generator, and then the attacker can choose messages to sign, which is not a forgery. A forgery means that the attacker is computing a message that was not signed by the actual legitimate signer. But, of course, it's a problem if the attacker can control the messages being generated. It's not a problem with the cryptography. It's a problem of this buffer overflow that has to be fixed. In any case, different applications, even if you fix the buffer overflows, different applications legitimately have different types of message generators. And you could, in principle, go through the different ways messages are generated and analyze each one for its security, but then, well, as a cryptographer, I'm much happier saying, okay, no matter what the message generator does, no matter how crazy it sounds, I'll be running quickly through some examples of attacks, and some of them will rely on the message generator doing something that sounds weird, but I don't want to have to look at an application and see whether applications actually do that weird thing. I don't want to have to tell users you're going to lose security if you do something unusual in your message generator. So I'm much happier saying that no matter what the message generator does, no matter what control, what influence the attacker might have over it, and no matter what the attacker does, if the attack is feasible, takes a reasonable amount of time, resources, then the probability of a successful forgery at the end of the attack is small. First example of an attack that I have in mind, well, remember the first RSA attack was just choose your message being 1 and your signature being 1. So here you can try to do the same thing. Choose E to be 1 and F to be 1 and S to be 1 and choose H, well, H is just 1, say, and then look for a message. You don't look at any legitimately signed messages here. The attacker just tries to compute some message whose hash is 1. And if he succeeds in doing that, it's much more difficult than before just writing down 1 as the message. Now we need to find a message whose hash is 1. But he can try doing that by, for instance, guessing random messages. Here I've said uniform random. Uniform means, okay, these random variables are uniformly distributed. Every possibility is equally likely. And, well, there's some chance that any particular R prime and M prime give you a hash of 1. Or, well, if you vary your E prime, F prime, S prime, then you just calculate the probability here, and depending on how many output values of H there are, you figure out the chance that this works, and eventually it will work. If you have random E's, F's, S's, R's, and M's, then after a while you will bump into a successfully forged message, but that'll take a very long time. This is a very slow attack. In any reasonable number of guesses, you're not going to succeed in inverting H. Another attack, similar but using collisions, which you'd think are easier to find than inverting randomly. Well, instead of trying to find messages with hash value 1, try to find a couple messages, M prime and M, which if you stick some R's in front of them, give you the same hash value, a collision in H, where, again, M prime is different from M. And now the message generator does something unusual, but as I said before, we're not going to question the behavior of the message generator. We want security no matter what wacky stuff the message generator does. The message generator gives this message M that the attacker figured out to the signer. And then if the R's happen to match, extreme case, just assume there's no R's. I haven't said anything about the length of R, but in the Rabin-Williams system, you can have empty R's. There are 0 bits in all the R's. And in that case, the R's match, and the collision in H immediately implies that changing M to M prime gives you a successfully forged message. The only thing that doesn't work in this attack, assuming the short R's, is that, well, guessing collisions randomly has a very small chance of success. Depending on your function H, any reasonable choice of H, you're not going to bump into a collision in H just by randomly guessing. But of course, you don't have to randomly guess, which brings me to attack number 3. And this is the first attack I'm writing down that actually works against some cases of Rabin-Williams and RSA and so on type signatures. A lot of hash functions H that you might write down, that people in the real world did write down, were determined by MD5. If H looks like MD5 of the input and then expanded somehow to, say, 2048 bits, then by finding a collision in MD5, you have, of course, found a collision in H. And, well, in 2004, Wang explained to us how to find collisions in MD5. If you want to formalize this by randomizing things in various ways or using Rogoway's formalization of human ignorance, then you might, for instance, say, okay, I've got some random prefix to my messages and I can find collisions with that random prefix. It's easy to say formally what's going on here. And anyway, Wang explained how you can do this. And then once you have collisions in this type of function H by something which is not blind guessing, you're paying attention to MD5 here, but okay, if MD5 is a function in use, you can find these collisions and then go ahead and forge exactly as in attack number 2. And this works if H has this MD5 form. There's a couple reasonable things that people have been doing in response to this. One of them is saying, okay, switch from MD5 to SHA-256. Or there's even better ideas out there. SHA-256 is the oldest hash function in which people have a reasonable level of confidence. There's newer state-of-the-art designs where people have even more confidence. But you can switch from MD5 to something where there's reasonable conjectures that it will be hard to find collisions. You could also say, okay, there was another assumption in the attack. Beyond finding collisions, the attack relied on some R values colliding. Otherwise, collisions in the H inputs don't turn into forgeries. There's some R being produced by the signer, which is, say, a random B bit string. And if that doesn't match the R double prime that was used in the forgery, then used in the collision, then you won't have a forgery. So Rabin actually suggested having a 60-bit R. Back then, 60-bit sounded like a lot of R's to search through. Nowadays, we might say 256-bits. If you just wanted to deal with the 1/4 of messages being signable that I said before, then 60 bits was obviously massive overkill. But Rabin speculated that having a long R would annoy the attacker. And then later on, Schnorr, in the context of, well, Schnorr signatures, said, hey, you could actually get away with a half-size hash function from what people typically use. Actually, this aspect of Schnorr's system isn't as well known as it should be. People often think that Schnorr used a full-size hash, which makes the signatures considerably longer. But Schnorr gave exactly this argument for let's use a half-size hash and make the signatures shorter. In the Rabin-Williams context, well, it's not so clear that randomizing the hashes is a good idea. And you can reasonably argue for both sides of this. You could say, well, both of these reactions to MD5 collisions rely on conjectures. You always have some hash function, you always have to conjecture that it's secure, and then what's the strength of the conjecture? Well, maybe if you randomize, then you're only making a weaker conjecture about inversions. And maybe that reduces the load on your hash function, lets you get away with some simpler hash function, some faster hash function. On the other hand, for Rabin-Williams signatures, when you have a long R, you need to take time to generate that R and to transmit that R, and that's a cost that can easily outweigh the benefit of having your H be faster. I have my own feelings about which of these arguments is more convincing for various applications, but for this talk I'm going to be agnostic about it and say, well, some people want short R's, some people want long R's, let's consider both extremes. Another attack is, of course, factorization. Almost done with my quick summary of some sample attacks. Factorization consists of, I want to emphasize the role of money here. You send money to somebody who does computational number theory and say, here's a number, oops, when I wrote n here, I meant pq. You say, here's a pq, and please give me p and q in some order. And that will be enough to let you go ahead and forge messages of your choice. You can follow the legitimate signing algorithm to come up with signatures of whatever messages you want. Now, it's interesting to compare the original RSA papers. In 77, Martin Gardner's article gave a 129-digit challenge number PQ. In the 78 paper, RFNA suggested having a 200-digit PQ. And, well, just in 2005, the number field sieve succeeded in factoring a 200-digit number. The number field sieve has very little dependence on the input and how long it takes, so we could factor any 200-digit number in the same amount of time. The original recommendation from RFNA is now toast. But, of course, you could have a longer number. And this is another attack that, well, if it works, then you haven't chosen your numbers to be hard enough to factor. Maybe we'll have faster factorization algorithms someday. Maybe we'll have quantum computers which kill the whole system, but well, hopefully you keep track of that news and adapt your system accordingly. There's worse attacks. Here's my last example of an attack in the literature, is detecting leaks from the signer. There's some easy ways for the signer to give you information through what you might consider a covert channel, but, well, the signer might not be doing this deliberately. The signer has lots of choices of a signature. Remember, a signature has some R, which the signer is supposed to choose randomly, and the signature has an E, F, and S, where there are four choices of that. Even if you exclude R, have 0 bits in R, B is 0, then there's 4 choices of E, F, and S, and that's easily enough for the signer to accidentally give you the whole secret key. The signer could take the first bit of the prime key and stick it into the first message, into the signature, through, for instance, the first bit of R, or through whether S is positive or negative, I mean, between 0 and half of PQ, or between half of PQ and all of PQ, that one bit of information that's easily detected by the attacker, or it could leak through Jacobi symbols. I'm not suggesting that any Raven-Williams signers actually do this crazy kind of making bits of the prime available. And you might even think, well, just by assuming that the choice of E, F, S, and R is somehow independent of P and Q, that you could avoid all these attacks, which is not true. The point I want to make here is that your choice of signing algorithm, how you determine your R and E and F and S, is something which will affect security. Certainly, if you choose your signing algorithm badly enough, then your security disappears entirely. So you do have to, if you're going to do a security analysis, pay attention to the signing algorithm. To recap the situation, there's all sorts of attacks. There's, I've just given five examples. There's lots and lots of attacks against the Raven-Williams system, which are generally failures, but, well, these attacks will try to exploit properties of the hash function, or properties of the modulus, or things the signer do badly, or, well, there's lots of different attacks, and you can point to some of them. I won't claim all of them, but some of them, many of them, maybe even most of them, are generic with respect to the hash function, which some people might say, translation of the same thing into different terminology, these are attacks that work in the random oracle model. These are attacks that work for every H. Or, well, maybe they work for half of all H's. Where, when I say all H's, I mean you take all functions with the right input size and output size. Assuming that you have every party is using an oracle. The signer is using H to evaluate H of RM, and the verifier is doing the same thing, and then the attacker is also given an oracle for this function. That allows us to consider non-computable functions H and average over all functions H, not just the computable or quickly computable ones. And a lot of the attacks out there, for instance factorization, have this feature of being generic with respect to the hash function. So they'll work with every hash function. Now, some of the attacks, like signing leaks, leak detection that I just mentioned, where you copy secret information into your choice of signature, which again is something you might do accidentally. I'll get to the standard example of that in a bit. Signing leaks are much faster from the attacker's perspective than factorization, and if you're designing one of these systems and it's broken by a signing leak, then you're embarrassed by it. So this is a kind of vague definition, but I'll say an embarrassing attack is an attack that works for every hash function faster than factorization. And the one thing that we can usefully prove about the security of some of these systems is that there are no embarrassing attacks. This line of work started with Fiat and Shamir, who proposed a different signature system and said, all right, this is a system where there could be some embarrassment, but it won't be too extreme. You won't have an insanely fast attack unless you have pretty fast factorization. They had a polynomial time reduction between any generic attack and a factorization algorithm. If you give them a generic attack, they'll give you a factorization algorithm and prove that the slowdown and the loss of probability of success in that conversion is polynomial in the security parameter, in the input size, if you like, the size of your key. Bellari and Rogaway in 96 said, okay, we can do even better. Here's another signature system which is immune to embarrassment. If you give us an H generic attack, then we'll convert it into a factorization algorithm, and the loss of speed, the loss of probability is negligible. It's something where we have a factorization algorithm as fast as the original generic attack. There's lots more theorems along these lines. These are usually referred to as reductions in the random oracle model, but I'm forced to wonder when I see the amount of confusion caused by the phrase random oracle model. For instance, I was hearing Dan Brown talk about parts of the results he's going to be talking about this week, and one question from the audience was, why doesn't this proof work in the random oracle model? Which, if you phrase that as, why doesn't this work for generic attack, you instantly see why it's a silly question, but the random oracle model somehow obscures easy-to-see facts about these types of conversions. Anyway, not worrying too much about the terminology, I'll stick to generic attacks for now. There's certainly flaws in the theorems. There are people who have reductions that are maybe kind of tight, but not very tight. There are theorems where the tightness is only loosely quantified. There's some, for instance, big O's where the constants can be gigantic and make much more of a difference than some other variables in the theorems. There are certainly gaps and outright errors in proofs along these lines, the most spectacular example so far being the OAEP proof, which turned out to be just wrong in the generality claimed, although fortunately rescuable for the OAEP examples that people care about. And then the part of the theorems that I dislike the most, in almost all of the literature, you find theorems about systems that users don't want because they're slow. For instance, RSA with large exponents instead of RSA with exponent 3 at least, or preferably Rabin-Williams. Now, what I want to tell you today is three examples of systems that users do like, systems that are really fast, state-of-the-art systems from a speed perspective, that also have these optimal security proofs, the best security proofs that we have for any of these systems. I've been doing this sort of to confirm my own feelings about the design of these systems for some years, but just recently I found my interest in this topic reinvigorated by reading carefully something that Koblitz and Menezes were saying. I'll say a bit more about that later, and realizing that actually one of the variants, a full domain hash variant, has a very tight proof which contradicted what I thought everybody was saying about full domain hashes, and so I'd like to say a bit about that as well as summarizing some other non-full domain hash Rabin-Williams variants. Let me say here what the three examples of typical state-of-the-art systems are, starting with the full domain hash version of Rabin-Williams. So here I'm specifying a signing algorithm along with a length of R. Let's say fixed zero-bit unstructured Rabin-Williams. This has a what you might call a tight security reduction in the random oracle model. It's immune to embarrassment. If you have a generic attack against the system, you get a factorization algorithm at essentially the same speed, essentially the same success probability. What do the pieces of this definition mean? Well, zero bit means there's no R. This is doing what people call FDH, where you take the message and you hash it, and then you use that hash in your signature somehow. The somehow is then, well, unstructured means that you choose your EFS randomly. Remember, there were four choices of EFS, and that choice is, when I say unstructured, I mean that for whatever message is coming in, the choice of EFS is uniform random. Each choice is equally likely, and of course independent of everything else going on, including the P and Q and all the other choices for different messages. However, if you see the same message again, fixed here means that if you see the same message again, then you choose the same signature again. And this is clearly critical for security. Standard example of what not to do is varying, so variable here means not fixed. If you see the same message again and you choose a different signature, somebody looking at both of those S's, that's a leak. Somebody has a 50% chance of finding P or Q. And if you see several signatures for the same M, you've got a great chance of factoring PQ, finding P and Q. So it's really important. This fixed property is really important for real world security as well as for the proof that the system is immune to embarrassment. So let me not downplay the role of the fixed here. It's a really critical assumption in the system. You might worry about this property of choosing the same signature whenever you see the same message again, that seems like it's expensive to accomplish. You have to remember all the random signatures that you chose. And if, in fact, you do choose the signatures randomly, independently, then, well, you do need memory to record those choices. But let's just use secret key cryptography and say, okay, you don't actually have to make random choices. You just have to make something that looks random. So you can take a secret, not your P and Q, take some other secret string, part of your secret key, and then hash that together with M, and you can easily formalize what the hashing needs to accomplish for you, and that gives you random bits. This was proposed by Barwood and Wigley independently in 1997. And then you get something which, assuming the usual secret key cryptography conjectures, you get something indistinguishable from random. And if you see the same message again, then you'll produce the same bits again. There's no variation. The M completely determines your result here, although it determines it in a secret way that appears random to everybody else. At the bottom here, I've listed some typical examples of functions which you can use to do this hashing. And what I want to emphasize is the performance, poly 1305, typical Wegman-Carter style message authentication code. While hash function, universal hash function, takes typically 4 or 5 cycles per byte, I've realized that that can be combined with some cool ideas by Winograd to chop the number of cycles per byte almost in half, and then pick your favorite stream cipher. Well, used appropriately, it should be a PRF here, but you can easily take whatever ciphers, secret key ciphers you have in mind to scramble the universal hash output, and that gives you your random bits, well, seemingly random bits, to feed into the choices E, S, and F here. All right, so there's no need to record any choices of signatures for messages. Another example of a system immune to embarrassment. Suppose you take fixed one-bit principle, Raven-Williams. Okay, what do these mean? One bit is the length of R. Everybody uses a single bit R for the signatures. Principle means that if you could have E being plus or minus 1, you always choose 1. If you could have F being 1 or 2, you always choose 1. And, well, you always have, almost always have a choice of S, choose the S that is a square. And this uniquely pins down an EFS. There's only one choice of EFS that satisfies these conditions. That is the principal square root, well, with the E and F tweaks from Williams, that's the principal square root of your hash value. This signing algorithm using one bit R's, and again with the fixed property, this is also immune to embarrassment. This almost follows from a theorem by Katz and Wang, who considered fixed one-bit RSA and more generally fixed one-bit claw-free permutation pairs. The only problem is that claw-free permutation pairs are not general enough. The idea instantly works for this system, for the security proof, but the concept of claw-free permutation pairs just doesn't apply to Raven-Williams. For instance, you can't, as a verifier, recognize principal signatures, and that immediately kills the claw-free permutation pair idea. Something you can recognize, if I changed principle to this last example of a system, then you could make claw-free permutation pairs work, but you would need to slow down the verifier, which is, again, a difference between what theorems do and what the users want to do. I want theorems that apply to the fastest systems. What users are attracted to is the fastest systems out there, and, well, I certainly don't want verifiers computing Jacobi symbols. Anyway, my third example of a system here is if you like long R's, you could have a 128-bit R, and then as a variation in principal signatures, you might prefer to have S being positive, by which I mean at most half of PQ, where S or minus S is a square. So you start with the principal square root, the square root that's a square, and then you take its absolute value, which actually saves a bit in the transmission. Don't have to transmit the top bit of S anymore. And I also want to emphasize that everything I'm saying here is consistent with all the implementation tweaks and improvements, variations that people like to use. For instance, you don't need Jacobi symbols in computing principal or absolute principal signatures. All right, how do you do these proofs? Well, simplest case of a security reduction is suppose we have a way to compute square roots with the E and F tweaks, so basically square roots of random numbers H prime. So what are you given here as input? Suppose you have an algorithm that has a public key PQ, which I'm going to specify the size of. It's 2049 bits, the top bit always being set. And then you're given an H prime, which is a uniform random 2048-bit number. Think of this as the output of a hash function, where the hash function is a uniform random hash function from the set of all possible hash functions. And then H prime is an output for some message which you're trying to forge the signature of. The attacker looks at the hash value and then tries to compute the square root of it, like sort of reversing the first attack that I was talking about. Well, if you have an algorithm that computes square roots, then everybody knows you convert that into a factorization algorithm. And the way you do that with the E and F tweaks is you say, all right, I'm going to generate the H prime input here as the square of something random. And then when the algorithm here comes up with the square root of that, then that square root's going to be independent of my square root. Well, here's the factorization algorithm. You generate your random EF and F, and then H prime is uniformly distributed, EFS squared. Remember, every EFS squared is, it's exactly a 4-to-1 map, so every H prime is equally likely. And then if H prime is too big, you start over. Often people will state these full domain hash proofs, imagining that the hash function is producing outputs between 0 and PQ minus 1, which although doesn't reflect cryptographic practice, but it's an easy tweak to these algorithms to limit the range of your hash functions to be independent of P and Q just requires restarting a couple times on average. And then feed this H prime, which is a random number, to the algorithm that's supposed to compute a square root of it. And that gives you a square root S prime, which has a good chance of having, if you subtract your original square root S from it, has a good chance of having a factor in common with PQ. This algorithm is certainly doing just a little bit of work beyond running the algorithm A1, unless A1 is incredibly fast and factorization is incredibly fast. The loss of time here is negligible, and, well, okay, standard argument, again, I'll just briefly say the slide here is saying the usual S is independent from S prime, because the attacker does not see which S you had. He just sees H prime, and so S could have been any of the square roots, which makes this greatest common divisor have essentially a one-half chance of having a factor in common with P and Q. And if you want to pump that up to exactly one-half or a bit bigger, that's easy to do. If you assume that the attack is successful some fraction of the time for random hash values, uniform random hash values, then you get the same success chance with this divided by 2 for the factorization algorithm. All right, so that's a very well-known reduction. And this, you should imagine this saying, this is the simplified analogy to you have an attack that looks at one hash value for one message and then tries to compute a square root of that hash value. But of course, attacks can do much more. For instance, an attack could feed a message to the signer, look at the hash value there and see a square root of it from the legitimate signer, and then look at a hash value of another message and try to compute a square root of that. So the inputs here, there's an H and an H prime, which are independent, uniform, random hash values, well, numbers between 0 and 2 to the 2048 minus 1. And then the algorithm is given as input H along with a square root of it, S, well, an EFS, which I'll specify the distribution of this below. And then the algorithm is given this other H prime, independent of H, and wants to compute a square root of H prime, or maybe tweaked square root of H prime. Can you come up with an algorithm that computes this square root of H prime given the square root of something else? Now, the answer to this really could depend on how the E, F, and S are generated, although not too much. But you, as I was saying before, you have to worry about how the signer is producing E, F, and S. And at least logically, there are three separate questions here for the three different ways of computing E, F, and S. They could be random, so unstructured here means H is random and the signer produces a uniform random one of the four choices for EFS, or the signer produces principal EFS, and that changes the distribution of inputs, or the signer produces absolute principal, and that also changes the distribution of inputs here. And, okay, down at the bottom here I said the analogy, which is the attack is seeing the signature of one message and then tries forging a signature of another message. That's what this A2 is a model of. Now, the intuition here is that H, E, F, and S don't help at all, that computing the square root of H prime is just as hard whether or not you see the H, E, F, and S. And in general, when you're trying to formalize a lack of knowledge, you do it by proving that you can simulate the extra inputs that you're given. So a simulated signer, here's a fact, is that you get no information from H, E, F, S. What that means is that there is a fast simulated signer algorithm that given a public key PQ, not given the P and Q, will do exactly what the signer would do, generating a random H and generating E, F, and S that are square roots of H. So exactly the right distribution. Well, that depends on whether in position 1, 2, or 3. But the simulated signer will generate a uniform random hash value H and a square root F of that H. If you believe what I just said about the existence of the simulated signer, then of course you can convert this algorithm A2 into the algorithm A1 of the shape I said before, where A1 just generates the HEFS using the simulated signer and then goes ahead and runs the A2 algorithm. So if A2 has a good chance of success, then it's being given exactly the right distribution of inputs here. Its chance of success for random inputs is exactly the chance of success of this A1 that I've specified, depending on A2. And then having converted A2 into A1, you can then convert A1 into a factorization algorithm. If you have an algorithm A2 that works frequently, or all the time, but let's say the probabilistic version, works frequently for inputs distributed the way I've specified, then you get a factorization algorithm that is about the same effectiveness, except for a factor of 2. How do you compute this HEFS? How do you do the simulated signer? Well, The standard trick is you just generate S first and then compute H from it. Generate a uniform random S and then square it to get H. Well, in the unstructured case, exactly what you do is generate E being plus or minus 1, F being 1 or 2, S being anything between 0 and PQ minus 1, compute EFS squared, and then there's this range limit on H. Try again a couple times if necessary to find an H in the right range. This produces a uniform random H along with the square root of it. Not in the way the signer would have done it, but it's producing exactly the right distribution of HEFS. You have to go to more work if you have principal or absolute principal square roots. Let me just briefly say for principal square roots, you generate the square root first, and then you have to think a little bit about the conditions on E and F. You start from your X, and then if X happens to have a factor in common with PQ, which is, of course, extremely unlikely, and then you can abort the whole simulation anyway and say, ha ha, I have a factor. Well, maybe X is zero, in which case you also have to think a bit, but basically you compute X and then tweak E and F in obscure cases to get exactly the right distribution to simplify the overall structure of the proof, and then compute S as the square of X. Remember, the definition of a principal square root is that S is a square. And so you just manufacture a square by starting with its square root, generating the S, and then computing H as F squared. And then similarly for absolute principal. Easy to do. All right, next level up in complexity is suppose you have, let me start with the analogy down at the bottom, suppose you have an attack that looks at Q different messages, sees their signatures, and of course sees their hash values, which are Q independent uniform random hash values between 0 and 2 to the 2048 minus 1, and then chooses another message, M prime, its hash in some H prime, tries to figure out a square root of that H prime. So formally, the inputs of this A3 throwing the messages away are, it's some algorithm that is given the key and the h prime of which it wants a square root, and then square roots of a bunch of independent h1 through hq, and then it tries to compute e, f, and s. Well, it tries to compute an s prime whose square is h prime. As in the previous A2 case, you have to distinguish these questions. The answers are different. The reductions have slightly different efficiency depending on whether you have your E, F, and S for each of these H's being unstructured or principal or absolute principal. But okay, once you know how to do that for one, you can do it for all of them. As in the case of seeing one message and then forging one, seeing one signed message and then forging a new signature. If you have many, then the intuition is you learn nothing from seeing these square roots of random numbers because you could yourself have come up with square roots of random numbers. And, well, I've already told you how to do that. So you just do that Q times. Am I saying anything else on this slide? Well, okay. At the middle here, looking ahead to converting this into the actual reduction involving an attack against a bunch of messages. Something the attacker can do that's not modeled by this analogy is I have independent uniform random H1, H2, etc. through HQ. But suppose the attacker feeds in the same message again. Then he's not going to get, let's take the extreme case that the R's are empty, B is zero, there's no bits of randomness. Then he's going to get the same hash values. If he fed in the same message Q times, he does not get independent H1 through HQ. He gets the same H1 through HQ. So you could ask different questions here for suppose the attacker has some pattern of repetitions in the M1 through MQ, and then that changes the distribution of H1 through HQ and changes the probabilities here and changes how the simulation would have to work for a reduction. But this is all dealt with by having fixed signatures. When you have fixed signatures, you don't have to worry about repetitions in messages because a repeated message just gives you a repeated signature. That's the definition of a fixed signature. So all the decisions you make in choosing a signature are repeated if you see the same message again. And so you don't have to worry about the M's repeating. You can just assume all the messages are distinct. All right, one last level up in complication is suppose that instead of seeing some hashes, seeing some signatures of messages, and then making another hash and trying to forge that one, suppose that you have some intermixed, you see hashes of a lot of messages, and then you decide which one you're going to try to forge a signature of. Suppose you see a lot of H's, and after seeing a bunch of square roots of some of the H's, which you select, you then pick one of the H's to find a square root of. This is not exactly the same problem because, well, you have some extra flexibility here as an attacker. This type of algorithm A4 that's given a bunch of hashes, and I'm assuming here that there's no randomness for the statement here. I'll get back to generalizing in a moment. You choose a bunch of messages. You look at their hash values, and those are, let's say, Q plus one messages total. And now we're not assuming the first Q are the ones that you'll feed to the legitimate signer and the last one is the one that you'll forge. There's just Q plus one indistinguishable messages. Here's the uniform random H values. And then the algorithm picks some of them, after looking at the H values, picks some of them to see signatures on and maybe gets more information by cleverly deciding which of the H's will reveal the most information and then chooses one of the remaining H's, let's say choose Q of them to see legitimate signatures on, and then there's one remaining H, try forging a signature, try finding a square root of that last H. As before, well, okay, the success of the algorithm, it means you're forging a signature on a new H value. And as in the previous cases, you should ask, what's the chance that this algorithm succeeds? Can we relate that to the chance of a factorization algorithm succeed? Well, the standard way to relate this problem to the non-permuted problem, the case that I dealt with a moment ago with A3 having H1 through HQ and then an H prime, the classic reduction between these is to just guess which of the H's it'll be. For instance, maybe you guess it's H3. Make a uniform random guess of which H will be the H prime, and then just relabel and you have exactly the previous shape of the algorithm. So with a 1 over Q plus 1 chance, the chance of your guess being the same as what the algorithm produces at the end, you turn this problem A4, this type of algorithm A4, into the previous type of problem, which immediately gives you a factorization algorithm. If you could guess which I prime, which of the H values the algorithm's going to try doing a square root of, then you're in the previous situation. This probability loss is kind of annoying. Depending how big Q is, this might suddenly turn some low probability factorization algorithms like the elliptic curve method into the leading factorization algorithms out there if you multiply their probabilities by a factor of Q plus 1. Again, depending how big Q is. It's not a tight reduction. There's a serious probability loss here, and to compensate for that, you might want to increase your key sizes. Koran improved the situation somewhat by saying instead of having Q plus 1, the number of hash queries, you can look at the number of signing queries, which in practice is something more limited than the number of hash queries. The signer can say, okay, I'm only going to sign a billion messages, and that somewhat improves the overall success chance of this reduction. Well, it's a better reduction, which is more practical. It means you have to increase your key sizes by less if you want to compensate for it. But it's still a problem. It's still not a tight reduction. And Koran in 2002 proved theorems which, well, his statement of it was, the theorem says, it's not possible to further improve the security proof of full domain hash. But actually it is, at least for unstructured Rabin-Williams. If you skip A3 and say, what's the whole reduction from A4 to A0, from this problem down to a factoring algorithm, converting A4 to A3, what we're doing is guessing some index of a hash value, and then for the remaining hashes, you come up with unstructured signatures for those, some random EFs and Ss, and then what do you do with the selected index? Well, remember the reduction to a factoring algorithm. That did exactly the same thing. It came up with a reduction. It came up with a reduction from H prime to factorization by saying, I'm going to generate a random EF and F. And because they're doing exactly the same thing, we just do that for every index. You don't have to guess which index it is because the complete reduction just doesn't care. You go directly from this problem A4 to the factorization algorithm by, for each index, generate your H sub I. I stated it down here. For each of your i's, you generate a uniform random e sub I, f sub I, and s sub I, and then multiply ei by fi by si squared to give you hi, and then, well, try again if you're out of the right range for hi. And now go ahead with the algorithm A4, which eventually chooses one of the i's as the one of which it'll give you a square root, having no idea which your square root was, and that lets you factor. You don't have to worry about reducing A4 to A3. I don't know a good reduction from A4 to A3, but you just go directly from A4 to A0. If you look at Koran's theorem, then, well, the relevant phrase, which has a precise definition that I won't go through, but it's reasonably intuitive, he assumes there's a unique signature of each message. And certainly in this case, there are multiple choices of the S's, which is exactly what gives us this nice reduction to factorization, is that the signatures are not unique. There's multiple signatures for a message. All right, I'm basically out of time and I have 4 slides left. Let me say for these 2 slides, what I wanted to say is what to do if you want to handle something other than unstructured. And while I have the problem statement here of exactly the analogy to seeing hashes on messages and then deciding which ones to get signatures of, etc. And well, as I said before, there's a theorem of Katz and Wang where the theorem is too limited as it's stated, but the idea is almost as simple as the idea that I just stated and handles principal signatures, absolute principal signatures, as long as B is positive. You can't do it for full domain hashing, but as long as B is 1 or 128, well, something bigger than 0, then the Katz-Wang proof gives you unstructured Raven-Williams, principal Raven-Williams, absolute principal Raven-Williams. Anyway, I assume everybody's familiar with the Katz-Wang paper. The thing to remember is that, okay, you can do different proof, a classic proof at this point, if B is bigger than 0. The new proof is if B is 0 for unstructured. Anyway, there's lots of variations of the system where we have a reasonable security reduction. Second to last slide, I was just saying, well, okay, all this is related to this is easily something that you can convert an actual attack algorithm and its generic success probability into the types of problems that I've been stating. And all the problems I've been stating, this build up to A4, well, A4 in particular is just the Raven-Williams version of a very nicely stated problem by Koblitz and Menezes in a paper which I think some people have read. And in particular, this part of it got me thinking, hey, what about the Raven-Williams version? And that turned out to be very easy to answer. All right, last slide. I feel obliged to comment a bit on the random oracle debate. There's some extreme opinions that I've quoted here where some people will say, if you have a submission to the first or second tier cryptography conferences that does not have a theorem with an incomprehensible proof, then whatever you are proposing, we will simply throw it away. So if you have a crypto system that is not backed by a theorem that the typical referee doesn't understand, it must be a bad crypto system. Maybe even theorems that people do understand if they think it's interesting enough, then they might let it through. But it's easy to publish a crypto Eurocrypt paper if you have a theorem in it and follow the usual rules for what the theorems have to say. So there's this one feeling of, okay, you have to have proof. And for most systems, the only proofs we have are this type of immune to embarrassment proofs. And then there's other people who say, wait a minute, this is crazy because these proofs are just relative to, first of all, factorization you're assuming is hard or whatever basic problem is hard, and you're only considering generic attacks in the random oracle model. And in fact, you shouldn't even bother publishing these proofs because they don't say anything. And well, for me, I tried to say at the bottom here, my own intermediate, hopefully reasonable sounding position on this, which is I like these proofs because the proofs, for me as a designer, detect a whole lot of problems. There are all sorts of systems where by trying to do these proofs, you actually find a security hole in the system. There's all sorts of bad systems, which if we insist on proofs, we get rid of those systems. We don't have to spend time on them. The time saved by insisting on proofs is a lot more than the time we spend doing the proofs. I wouldn't be happy with insisting on proofs if it meant that I couldn't use the state-of-the-art systems. If I weren't able to use state-of-the-art Raven-Williams signatures because they didn't have the best proofs that people wanted, then I would be unhappy. But the whole point of my talk today is that there doesn't seem to be this type of conflict. Insisting on proofs doesn't seem to have this bad effect. We have tight security reductions for state-of-the-art Raven-Williams signatures. Thank you for your attention.